This is The Common Health from the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security, engaging senior leaders on questions of how to address our common health security challenges in this post-COVID moment. I'm delighted today to be joined by a close friend and colleague, Jennifer Cates. Jennifer is the Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health and HIV Policy Program at KFF, what we used to refer to as a Kaiser Family Foundation, now known simply as KFF. She oversees policy analysis and research focused on the U.S. government's role at both the global level and on the global and domestic HIV epidemics. And she played a very lead role during COVID in managing KFF's prodigious work on the COVID-19 pandemic. Jen, thanks so much for joining us. It's very generous of you. It's great to have you with us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. It's always good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I asked Jennifer to come on to try and unpack what people are beginning to refer to as a traffic jam in global financing. And what I mean by that is that in the period of late 2023 through some point in 2025, we'll hear more from Jen, we're seeing multiple convergent replenishments in that period of different institutions. Many of those institutions are very critical to public health. Many of them are multilateral institutions of some form. Some of them are international organizations. Some are UN agencies. Some are multilateral development institutions. Some of them have very narrow missions. Some have very broad missions. Within this group are the Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis, the World Health Organization, WHO, the World Bank's International Development Assistance Authority, IDA, and CEPI, which is of recent vintage, of scarcely less than 6 or 7 years ago, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Initiatives. And then, of course, we have the flagship program of the U.S. government on global health, which is PEPFAR, and we'll touch on that a little bit, President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So we've got a lot of different institutions who are out chasing funds in a similar time frame, and I wanted to make sense of this. First question to you, Jen, just describe what the state of play is here. As people step back and look at this, what are they thinking and how is this going to unfold? And what are the big questions on people's minds?
It's a great question. As you framed it, you know, there's a lot of big moments happening in global health. And this happens sometimes where there's more than one focus. We have to be realistic that politicians and others have limited capacity to hold on to multiple things at once. That's why people are calling it a bit of a traffic jam. And I think CGD did a really nice piece to that effect. Coming up really soon, and actually we talk about this, the WHO, the World Health Organization, for the first time is calling on, they're not calling it a replenishment, but an investment opportunity, which they've not done before.
And that's a two-year cycle, right?
Yeah. And then soon after that, the Pandemic Fund and Gavi are also doing replenishments. And then right after that is the Global Fund. I think it raises a lot of questions. It's challenging for those institutions because they have to do a very clear job of distinguishing themselves from the others and cooperating both on, I think, timing, and they have the same donor pool. Another thing that, you know, I think will kind of crashing a little bit into the reality here is it's not a great time to be asking for money. There's not a wallet out there that's ready to be opened up. I think it's the opposite. It's what can be sort of pried out from donors. And these replenishment moments and these investment moments are really important because they kind of set the stage.
Yeah.
So you want them to be successful. They're going to have these challenges. So I think it's going to be a difficult period to do that.
That puts it really nicely. The last cycle that we went through was roughly in the 2019 timeframe.
Yes.
The last big cycle was pre-COVID. There was a lot of anxiety at that time about, you know, trying to reach targets. Some institutions came in short of their ambitions. All of the institutions that I listed survived and continued to do good work. Then they went through COVID, which in some ways kind of rattled and expanded their agendas and pushed vast resources through them. And now then that contracted, and we're on the other side of COVID. And let me just put out a proposition and ask you to respond. The proposition would be the anxiety in this cycle is much, much higher. You've hinted at some of the reasons. Geopolitically, we've got an unresolved, massively expensive war in Ukraine, Russian invasion of Ukraine. We have the Hamas-Israeli war, which is turning out to be very, very costly, and we don't know what the uncertainty is there. We have elections coming up in big number of very powerful advanced economies and other economies in a populist moment, a global populist moment, which is anti-foreign aid oftentimes, anti-science at times, and anti-migration. And it's happening in a period also Ukraine has generated 5 or 6 million migrants into Europe. You've got climate change inducing migration. So it's a populist moment. It's also a moment where climate has climbed up the ladder dramatically. And with the most recent COP in Dubai, we'll have the next one, Azerbaijan, and then and we get to Brazil. You have the loss and damages fund established. You have a kind of maturation and graduation of climate as a force. The last thing I'd say is we've got on the post-COVID time, we're at the neglect phase of the cycle of crisis followed by neglect. It's a difficult period to get people terribly excited in that period. So tell us how you're thinking about this. Is that an accurate way of saying, look, this cycle, the anxieties and uncertainties are much larger than before. People have good reason to be concerned.
I agree completely. It's just a few years later, but everything has changed. The calculus, it has changed. In some of the work we do, we talk to donor governments about to collect data on their financing for different global health areas. And several have said, because of what's happening in Ukraine, because of what's happening, you know, and other crises, that it's putting a downward pressure on their official development assistance. That's a fact. And it's not one that I think global health is going to easily be able to solve. So for all of the reasons that you mentioned, I think it's a really difficult time. The other thing, I think you hinted at this by talking about climate. You know, you and I have been doing this work for a long time. We remember a decade ago where global health was the, you know, standout area of international development. Everyone looked at global health. It had, at the time, you know, the newest and most innovative institutions that were being developed, the Global Fund, Gavi, PEPFAR is a bilateral one, but really new ways of doing things and setting a different standard and were really held up as sort of models. We're beyond that phase now. And those, you know, to some extent, it's because they're the existing institutions and they're the ones that people know about. And you have to remind people about why they're important sometimes. But also, you know, there's some more skepticism about global health than we used to experience. I don't think it's a monolith, though, that, you know, of the four institutions we're talking about right now, WHO, Pandemic Fund, Gavi, and Global Fund, I think they face some slightly different outlooks.
Differentiate a little bit for our listener as to how that's playing through across those different four institutions.
I'll start with Gavi and the Global Fund, because I think, you know, those are the two specific global health financing institutions that were set up 2000 for Gavi, 2002 for Global Fund, that have historically had very strong donor support. And Gavi, you know, not as big an institution as the Global Fund, but I think in the last few years, it's gained more attention, obviously, because of COVID and COVID vaccines. But both of those institutions have a strong donor base. They have a replenishment cycle process. So the Global Fund's next replenishment is its eighth. Gavi's next replenishment will be its fourth. And there are signs from some of the capitals that you would want to be, you know, focused on, like the U.S. There's still really good, strong support in Congress for both the Global Fund and Gavi. And that, you know, Gavi just got its biggest amount funding in the final 24 bill than it's ever had. Congress and the president have met the pledge. So those are all good signs. And I think it's just there. It's keeping that momentum going and ensuring that whatever the outcome of the election is, holding on to that strong kind of congressional executive branch support, there's not a reason to believe that that would, you know, crash. Mm-hmm. I think when you get to the pandemic fund, on the positive, it's newer. People are talking about it. You know, it has a little bit more, you know, it has some new cachet. But it's also a pandemic, and there's some, particularly in the U.S. and Congress, who are, you know, anything pandemic is raising concerns and not, you know, just it's very political. And I think there's obviously the U.S. has given funding to the pandemic fund, but it's not garnering the same level of support. And I think the election outcome could affect that. I think WHO is obviously the most vulnerable here. WHO member states have said, we agree you need to have a different model. We have an assessed fee, which basically says, okay, donors, based on size of your government, this is the percent you're going to give to WHO as a member. But also the US, every other donor, the Gates Foundation, all come in and give WHO money for specific things. It's not a great way to budget. It doesn't allow WHO to have certainty or any kind of control. Right. So there's recognition of that. How do you fix it? Well, WHO is now asked to say, we're going to do an investment case and we're going to, you know, have this pledge period in a sense where we raise attention. That's, I think, on the one hand, it's a good response to that challenge. On the other hand, it's very vulnerable because think about what's going to happen in November. Right. The U.S. is going to have an election. If the election happens to be an outcome of President Trump, we know that from recent experience and from all indications in the campaign, they will not support continuing any kind of involvement in WHO. The U.S. has been historically and currently the number one or two donor to WHO. So to lose that support, particularly right as the investment opportunity comes, would be pretty a big blow to the WHO. You know, that I think that makes it the most vulnerable just because of the timing of its target and what it's going to, so much is going to hinge on what happens in November.
We have pressures coming from these elections. We have pressures coming from the proliferation of several simultaneous complex emergencies that are mostly tied to wars, which are hugely demanding and generate enormous need and generate migration and highly dependent populations. And a lot of governments, their budgets are getting depleted on the development side, whether you're talking about food security, health, climate, overall economic development. A lot of budgets are getting depleted to meet these other very urgent, worthy demands. We've got that happening. Climate has entered its big moment. And global health is looking like yesterday's priority versus today's high priority. But there's these durable institutions, the Global Fund, as you rightly point out, and Gavi coming out of this most recent funding cycle in the U.S., quite remarkable, quite remarkable. I want to focus a bit on the centrality of U.S. leadership here. I think you made a very important point. If President Trump wins the elections in November, the national presidential election, that'll have huge implications on across the board. And there's a lot of attention focused on the U.S. The U.S. economy is the strongest in the world right now. Mm-hmm. It's in remarkably strong shape. We're in a populist moment. The Republican Party, much of what we've said about the durability of bipartisan support for the Global Fund and Gavi rests on an older type of Republican Party. Obviously, there's still some strong sentiment there that, as we've seen in the omnibus bill, great generosity and enthusiasm for Gavi and Global Fund. But the party itself is becoming magnified steadily. And so even if Trump does not succeed in the presidential election, we're looking at a future with a different kind of political configuration in Washington. We've seen the way the anti-abortion sentiment spilled into the problems in getting a reauthorization for PEPFAR. We also have Project 2025 from President Trump's campaign. There's affiliated documents, but it's important to think about what those spell out. Plus, another thing for our listeners is President Biden struck a budget deal with former Speaker McCarthy, and that deal still applies, right, in terms of the caps. It's not like somebody comes forward with a big idea and says, well, let's just bump that up by X percent. It's not. So talk a little bit more about the centrality of U.S. leadership in this period. The world is watching with great interest and a certain high level of anxiety around what happens in this, because the outcomes for these institutions could be quite dramatic.
Just thinking about numbers for a minute. So the U.S. is the top donor to the Global Fund, and it has been since day one. The Global Fund's future is highly dependent on the U.S. And so that's one. On Gavi, the U.S., is not counting COVAX, is like the third largest donor. Again, very important. Pandemic Fund, second largest donor. And WHO has been one or two. So we're talking about a central player. And it's not just the funding. The U.S. government plays a pretty central role in the governance of these institutions, helping to set their policies, their criteria, accountability issues. And so when you have a strong U.S. engaged presence in those fora, it can make a difference in the outcomes, whatever, you know, direction the U.S. might want to be. So what we're looking at, depending upon the outcome of the election, or as you said, even if President Biden wins again, there's been a fundamental shift in U.S. political environment around international institutions. the Republican Party in general, other than probably some, you know, older guard, does not have an internationalist view. You know, it is President Trump's America First, but that really translates into what's in it for us and why should we be sitting at these tables? Why should we be providing money to these institutions? And in some cases, there are valid questions about the role of these institutions, and some of them might need some reform. I don't think that's the issue. It's really just about a really different stance, contrary to where the U.S. has been for decades, which is essential to all global discussions on just about everything. If the U.S. pulls out, it will, whether that's a funding reduction or a lack of support, the U.S. does a couple of things. There's the money and the governance, as I mentioned, but it's also the U.S. role in getting others to kind of step forward and come to these pledging moments. And whether the U.S. does that or not is going to make or break some of these, you know, because of the dynamics that you mentioned. It's hard to see that other donors would step up if the U.S. pulled out.
All of these institutions we've talked about are inherently partnerships, right? Where U.S. leadership has forged alliances with others, motivated others. The leadership has not just been, we are paying in transactionally for what our narrow piece of this is. We're paying in partnership with a range of different institutions and countries, and we're in it as an alliance. Have you had a chance to look carefully at Project 25 or the America First program and platform? What does that tell us?
Project 2025, which is put out by the Heritage Foundation and has different chapters based, you know, by department, by agency, was essentially written by former Trump administration officials. And as you said, it is sort of the blueprint for a potential Trump administration. In a nutshell, what that document says about the role of the U.S. globally, there's a pretty strong message, and there's a couple exceptions. The strong message is, why should we be involved in these global endeavors? And the next president, President Trump, should examine every single international institution and assess whether it's essentially worth our while. And singles out WHO as one, you know, we should definitely not be involved in that one, but we should assess all of them. That its stance is prove that we should be involved, not we're going to continue our longstanding involvement. So it's a very different approach. It questions the role, the utility, the you know, the organization of them, and also their agenda. Part of it is there's two kind of threads. One is, why should we be involved in the world in the way we have been in the past? And the other is, not only that, but we don't share the values with some of these institutions. They are promoting values that are not what the values we want to promote. And I can get to that in a minute. So that's pretty clear. There is a devotion of some real estate in there to PEPFAR, and it's pretty positive about PEPFAR. So I think that's interesting, given what we just went through. Mm-hmm. But going back to the values piece, throughout the Project 2025 document, whether you're talking about international engagement, domestic politics, very strong around anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ, anti-open view about what it means to be family and what promoting diversity and equity and inclusion. And so to the extent that some of the international institutions are associated with those in the eyes of the Project 2025 group, they are very much opposed to that. One of the clear policy recommendations in Project 2025, which would greatly affect the institutions we're talking about, is a proposal to significantly expand the Mexico City policy to way beyond what President Trump even had done, which was pretty significant, to include virtually all of foreign aid.
What that would mean, Jen.
So the Mexico City policy, when it has been in effect, which was first instituted by President Reagan, so been for 40 years, it's been in place when there's a Republican president and rescinded when there's a Democrat, and, you know, ping pongs around. And it's steadily expanded over time. It was fairly narrow when Reagan first introduced it, focusing on just one stream of funding at USAID for family planning. And then over time, it got broader until President Trump really expanded it beyond family planning to apply to global health. But there were still lots of limitations. It didn't apply to multilateral organizations. It didn't apply to money appropriated to HHS agencies. It didn't apply to humanitarian assistance. The Heritage Project says those were loopholes. And the next president should actually apply this policy to all of foreign aid, including multilateral organizations, including foreign governments, including U.S. organizations. Now, there's legal issues there. I think that if the next president came in and tried to institute a Mexico City policy as broadly as recommended, there would be some probably legal barriers to doing so. But the point is, there's a lot that the executive could do, and it would be very significant.
It would be an expression of the power within Republican ranks of the anti-abortion movement.
Yes, because people might not understand what the Mexico City policy says. Their proposal would say, if you want the U.S. to give you foreign aid, you have to agree not to support abortion, promote abortion, support abortion, and a whole range of activities around abortion with any money at all. This isn't about U.S. money. U.S. law has very strong prohibitions against using any U.S. money for abortion. This is about using other money that an organization might have, whether that's money from another donor, money that they've fundraised, whatever it is. If you want our money, you can't use your money to do these activities we don't want you to do. If this policy were to be put in effect as broadly as they are recommending, it would touch billions more dollars than has ever been affected by this and many more institutions than have ever had to deal with this. So it would create, I think, quite a challenge for global health.
Right.
And international assistance broadly.
That's a profound point. I want to move on to, in the time remaining, to two topics. One is the question of leadership. And what I mean by that is, when you look at these institutions, some of them have had strong and sustained leadership. Some of them have had interrupted leadership. Gavi has had a prolonged period of finding a new leader, and that person is coming on stream soon, but there's been an interregnum of drift. Peter Sands has been continuously at the helm, Global Fund, for a number of years and been, by all accounts, quite a strong leader and brings an unusual background in terms of his finance background and his savvy in negotiations. CEPI, I think you can make a case, has had, since its formation, continuous strong leadership in Richard Hatchett and his team. You look at the World Bank, where you're going to have some major changes. We're not dwelling that much on the World Bank and the IDA, but early days for Banga. PEPFAR, okay, we have a very strong person, John Nkengasong, in a newly established bureau at the Department of State, heading up PEPFAR and the global health security agenda writ large. But PEPFAR went through a 27-month period without a confirmed leader at the helm. So, you know, and the COVID didn't help a lot of these periods of interrupted leadership. COVID made it worse in many respects. So these institutions, they don't have uniform strengths on the leadership side. But it seems to me when you're entering a replenishment, it's highly competitive. And it's under all of these pressures that are going to push towards zero-sum funding decisions, ultimately. That leadership element becomes very, very important.
Definitely, as you point out. So Gavi has a new leader, Sonia Nishtar, who just started. So I think, you know, there's a real excitement about her coming on and having a woman lead that organization for the first time. You mentioned the Pandemic Fund has Priya Basu, who's heading that up. Leadership is really important, I think, for a couple of reasons. There's the institution itself, you know, to carry forward a replenishment or investment opportunity takes a lot of energy and time of the leader. That is one of their main jobs, and it is tough. The other thing I'd like to say, as somebody who cares about global health writ large, it's not just a zero-sum game. It's that these institutions, they really get pitted against each other.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help global health. It doesn't help each of the institutions. It ultimately can have some damage. So, you know, I think that's something to pay attention to and worry about. It's not going to serve anybody well at the end of the day if this really gets into that kind of a battle, but people get forced to make their own case because there's a lot of risk. And I think that it really is true. We need strong leaders at these institutions. We need U.S. leadership to kind of help instill that. As you mentioned, John Nkengasong is not only the leader of PEPFAR and the new bureau at State, but he's the board member for the Global Fund. He's the board member for the Pandemic Fund. So he's playing a key role in those two institutions, and obviously the U.S. in addition at WHO and Gavi. It's not going to be an easy time for these organizations. And the PEPFAR battle that we just went through, you know, was unheard of several years ago. None of us probably would have expected that to have happened, and it did. So, you know, it just says to me the ground has shifted, and I think that's a permanent shift.
So when we get around to the question of what's this traffic jam likely to look like, where is it going to lead us in this next phase? A couple of things we haven't talked about that are, I think, going to be important dimensions. I mean, there will be inevitably competitive pressures across these institutions. even as they try hard to deconflict and not engage in that sort of thing, which could be destructive, there's already a pitting of health against climate. We've heard that from Bill Gates. We've heard that from others. At a moment when people are finally coming around to say, you know, health and climate are very interdependent, we're now seeing it pitted as climate's out there and health is paying a price in its declining because of climate. We have competition between multilateral, big multilateral institutions versus thematic institutions, institutions that are disease specific or problem specific, like CEPI, creating, you know, innovation. We have tensions between the big and muscular versus the small and new. And there is oftentimes a reach where people say, well, we just need to expand the pool of donors. Well,
we've been saying that for a long time.
Been saying that a long time. There's no question that UAE, that China, that the Republic of Korea are playing a bigger role than before, but they tend to be not transformative in what they do, and they tend to be very neighborhood-based. Inevitably, in this period also comes the question of, why aren't countries doing more for themselves? And so we are entering this period where I think we're going to hear a lot more of that, about the competition and the clashes across those different dimensions. The question, why don't we have more partners here? Why aren't countries able to do more for themselves? So where do you think this debate's going to lead us in the next year or two?
Well, a lot's going to hinge on the election outcomes, not just for the U.S., but other countries. So that's one thing to watch. We don't know yet what the investment cases are going to be for these institutions. So that's also important. You know, how much they have to look at the landscape. They have to decide how much they calibrate towards a goal, which might be really virtually impossible to get to, but an important aspirationally versus a more realistic target. Having these organizations come through with clear delineations about how they work together, how they, you know, support each other's areas because they're complementary, is going to be really, really important. And I'm not sure it's going to be hard to convey that, but I think it behooves them to convey that they are, just thinking about these four institutions all tackling global health in different and complementary ways. And that has to be a clear part of what they convey to the world and what they convey to donors and what their value add is. And I think they all have that case. You know, they're going to be very focused on getting the mechanics of the replenishment going and the messaging here, not just their own messaging, but the messaging of what does global health look like today and who are the players today and why is it important, has to be ideally coordinated. I don't know if that will happen. The question is the traffic jam going to result in some crashes, or is it just going to slow things down or make it a little more difficult to maneuver? But at the end, everyone comes out of the tunnel and things open up. And that would be the best scenario, right? There's the highways there and everyone cruises forward. You know, I don't know if that will happen.
Given the tragically dilapidated nature of American transport infrastructure, it becomes uncomfortable when we start talking in these ways. Let's close with the question we put to everybody that comes on as our guest, which is, given the complexities and the barriers and the challenges that are all out there right now, in this particular issue set, what gives you the most hope and optimism?
I think what gives me the most hope and optimism is that despite all of this, there's actual real results here. And you can't always say that. You can't always measure it as well. And we could talk about needing to do better measurement in some areas, but for all the things that we just talked about, particularly for the Global Fund and Gavi that have been, they've been around for a period of time and actually have methodologies to measure, and PEPFAR, there's real results. They've actually changed people's lives. And I think, you know, stepping back, isn't that what global health is about? Is to improve outcomes for people in the countries in which the US and others are working. And they have done that. And, you know, it's that we can't lose sight of it. This isn't just about politics, and it's not just about who gets which money, and it's not just about who the CEO is. It's really about what are they doing to change people's lives? And is that improving health? And we can actually, you know, unequivocally say they're doing that. And that's pretty important. So that I have optimism over that.
Thank you. That's a great answer. This has been a terrific conversation. Thank you, Jennifer. This is a really timely and compelling problem set that we face.
It is. Maybe we can come back in a year or two and say what happened.
Right. Show our bruises and where we got things wrong and where we got things right. But we're going to see a lot of these leaders floating through town pretty soon. Spring meetings, IMF, World Bank meetings. we're going to see a lot of these people floating through town, some of them in our institutions fairly soon. So it's quite real. But thank you so much. This was terrific, Jen. And thanks for all your leadership on all these issues.
Thanks so much, Steve and CSIS.
Thank you for listening to The Common Health. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a follow and leave a review. To learn more about the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security or listen to other CSIS podcasts, please visit csis.org.